All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a Supreme Court case. It's a pretty fascinating one, and it really gets at the intersection of a few really interesting areas. We're talking crime and punishment, we're talking mental health, and of course we're talking about the law. The case is Jones v. United States, back from 1983, and it raises this kind of perplexing question. Can someone be locked up, potentially for life, even if they were found not guilty by reason of insanity?
You know, it's really interesting you frame it that way, because I think a lot of people would hear not guilty and think, well, that means you should be free to go. And that's where this case gets so complicated and so important, because it asks, what happens when someone's mental state, the very reason they were found not guilty, also raises concerns about their potential for future dangerousness?
It seems almost like a paradox, right? Like the system says you're not responsible for what you did, but then potentially uses that same lack of responsibility to justify keeping you confined. So how do we even begin to untangle this knot? Where do we even start?
Well, I think a good place to start is with the case itself. I mean, who was Michael Jones, and how did he end up at the center of this landmark Supreme Court ruling?
All right, let's do that. Give us the rundown. Who is this guy, and what was his story?
So we have to go back to September 1975. Michael Jones is arrested in Washington, D.C. for trying to steal a jacket. It was attempted petite larceny, which is like a really minor theft.
So not exactly a hardened criminal mastermind here.
Not at all. In fact, the maximum sentence for that crime at the time was just 1 year.
1 year.
Yeah, that's important to keep in mind as we go forward. But there's a twist. Jones was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. Now, the court actually found him competent to stand trial, meaning he understood the charges against him and could participate in his own defense. But he decided to plead not guilty by reason of insanity, or NGRI, as it's often called.
And the prosecution, they were okay with that.
They didn't challenge it. So in March of 76, the D.C. Superior Court accepts his plea and commits him to St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
So at this point, everything seems to be going kind of by the book. The system recognizes that sometimes someone's mental state means they're not fully culpable for their actions.
Right. And that's a really important principle in our legal system. But this is where things start to get complicated. Just 50 days after he's committed, Jones has a hearing, and a psychologist testifies that he's, well, still mentally ill and potentially dangerous. And based on that testimony, the court decides to continue his commitment.
Okay, so that makes sense in a way, right? You want to make sure he's getting the treatment he needs. But what happened next? How did this turn into a Supreme Court case?
So fast forward to February 1977. By this point, Jones has been hospitalized for over a year. Remember, that's longer than the maximum 1 year sentence he could have gotten for the original crime.
Right, that's longer than the 1 year.
And he's like, wait a minute. He demands to be released, or at least to have his commitment reviewed under the same standards they use for people who are civilly committed.
But the court said no.
The lower court denies his request. They said, nope, you're still under the NGRI ruling. The D.C. Court of Appeals even upholds that decision. But Jones, he's not giving up. He appeals all the way to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. So what was it about this case that made the Supreme Court take notice? I mean, they get thousands of appeals every year. Why was Michael Jones' situation so important?
It was a big deal because lower courts were all over the place in how they handled these NGRI cases. There was no clear guidance on what level of due process someone like Jones was entitled to, like should they have the same rights as someone facing civil commitment. And a big part of that was the standard of proof needed to continue someone's confinement.
Right. We've talked about standards of proof before on the show. It's basically how much evidence the government needs to prove their case, right?
Exactly. And a few years before Jones, in 1979, the Supreme Court had decided a really important case about civil commitment called Addington v. Texas. And in Addington, they said the state had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that someone was mentally ill and dangerous before they could be committed.
And clear and convincing, that's a pretty high standard.
Right.
Higher than the preponderance of the evidence standard,
yeah.
Which is like, what, more likely than not?
Right, much higher. Clear and convincing means the evidence is highly and substantially more likely to be true than not true. So the question in Jones was, should that same clear and convincing standard apply when we're talking about continuing the commitment of someone who's already been found in GRI?
Okay, so we've got this guy, Michael Jones. He's facing a year in jail for a minor crime, but could end up locked up for much longer because of his mental health. And the Supreme Court is now trying to decide how much proof is enough to keep him there. What were the big, like, the constitutional questions that the court had to wrestle with?
The court basically had to answer two huge questions. The first was, can states continue to commit people found NGRI indefinitely, and can they do it based on this lower preponderance of evidence standard? And the second question was, should there be some kind of limit on how long someone can be committed under an NGRI ruling, even if they're still considered dangerous?
Big questions. And what did they say was the court's decision?
They came down pretty firmly on the side of the state. They said yes on both counts.
Wow, so they basically created a whole separate category for NGRI acquittees, right?
Yes. The court said that people found NGRI, they're not like regular criminals, and they're not exactly like people facing civil commitment either. And that meant states had more leeway in how they handled these cases.
Okay, so let's break down the majority opinion. Why did most of the justices come to this conclusion? What was their reasoning?
The majority opinion was written by Justice Powell, and they really hammered on a few key points. The first one was all about the NGRI verdict itself. The court said when someone's found NGRI, it means two things. First, that they actually did the crime, and second, they do it because of their mental illness.
Makes sense. So they're not disputing that a crime happened.
Right. And they said this combination, the act and the mental illness, it creates what they called an inference of ongoing danger. Justice Powell even wrote, and I'm quoting here, the insanity acquittal supports an inference of continuing mental illness.
So they're saying if someone committed a crime due to mental illness once, it's reasonable to assume they might do it again. But is that assumption alone? Is that enough to justify keeping them confined, maybe forever?
And that takes us to the court's second argument, which is all about the difference between NGRI acquittees and people facing civil commitment. In civil commitment, someone might be committed because of things they might do, behaviors that haven't necessarily crossed the line into criminal activity.
Okay, so like someone is acting erratically, maybe they're a danger to themselves, but they haven't actually hurt anyone.
Exactly. And the court said the clear and convincing standard from that Addington case that was specifically designed to protect people from being committed based on, you know, maybe just quirky or harmless behavior. But in NGRI cases, there's already been a crime, an act that proves the person is capable of dangerous behavior.
So it's like the crime itself becomes evidence of potential future dangerousness.
Precisely. And their third point was all about the purpose of commitment after an NGRI verdict. The court said it's not about punishment, it's about treatment and protecting the public.
So the focus shifts from what they did in the past to what they might do in the future.
Exactly. They're saying because the goal is treatment and safety, not retribution, there's no logical reason to tie the length of commitment to the potential sentence for the crime.
Interesting. It's like they're creating a whole separate track for these cases, one that's not bound by the usual rules of criminal sentencing.
Right. And lastly, the court said the preponderance of evidence standard, that lower standard, it's good enough for both the initial commitment and for the periodic reviews that happen afterward. They argued that the initial NGRI finding itself already suggests there's a mental illness at play.
Okay, because to get that NGRI vert in the first place, the defendant already had to prove they were insane, at least by preponderance of evidence.
Right.
Right.
And while they said regular reviews are important, they didn't think the government should have to prove clear and convincing evidence at every single review to justify keeping someone committed.
Okay, so the majority opinion is pretty clear-cut. But what about the justices who disagreed? What did the dissenting opinions have to say?
There were two dissenting opinions, one from Justice Brennan and one from Justice Stevens, and they both raised some serious red flags about the majority's decision. Justice Brennan, he argued that an NGRI acquittal for something minor, like the attempted petite larceny in Jones's case, that shouldn't automatically open the door to potentially lifelong confinement. He thought once that maximum sentence for the crime is passed, in this case 1 year, the state should have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the person's still mentally ill and dangerous if they want to keep them locked up.
That seems pretty fair. I mean, it prevents someone from being held indefinitely for a relatively minor offense.
Right. And Justice Stevens, he offered kind of a compromise. He said confinement based on the NGRI verdict, it could last for the same amount of time as the maximum sentence, but anything beyond that should require the higher, clear, and convincing standard.
So they both agree that at some point, the state needs to bring more to the table than just more likely than not. They need to show stronger proof to justify keeping someone confined, especially if the crime itself wasn't that serious.
Yeah, that was their big concern. They were worried about what they called punitive confinement disguised as treatment. Like, what if someone gets committed for a minor crime and then they end up spending decades in an institution, even longer than someone who is actually convicted and sentenced for the same crime? and they didn't think that preponderance standard provided enough protection against that kind of injustice.
It really highlights the potential for things to get out of balance, right? Like, how do we make sure commitment is really about treatment and safety and not just a roundabout way to punish someone indefinitely? So what's been the impact of Jones v. United States? Why are we still talking about this case almost 50 years later?
Well, Jones had a huge impact on how we deal with NGRI acquittees. First of all, it solidified their status as a separate legal category, meaning they're treated differently than regular criminals and people facing civil commitment.
So the rules are different for them.
Exactly. And secondly, Jones locked in that preponderance of evidence standard, not just for the initial commitment, but for all those periodic reviews too. So while the case said those reviews have to happen, it also said the government doesn't have to clear that higher, clear, and convincing hurdle every time.
So that means it could be pretty hard for someone found NGRI to ever get released, even if their mental health improves over time.
Right. That's the worry. And it gets at the third major impact of Jones.
Yeah.
It really kicked off this whole debate about balancing public safety with the individual rights of people found NGRI. Critics say the Jones ruling can essentially turn into a life sentence for someone who maybe committed a minor crime, all because of their mental health history.
And that's just to Stephen's point, right?
Right.
About the shoplifter potentially getting locked up for longer than someone who actually got convicted of shoplifting. It shows how the punishment, or at least the confinement, can get way out of proportion to the original offense.
Absolutely. And one question that's still being debated today, even after Jones, is whether the type of crime, like whether it was violent or nonviolent, should play a bigger role in deciding whether to commit or release someone who's NGRI. Lower courts are still trying to figure out how to apply the Jones principles in a fair way that considers the specific details of each case.
So Jones v. United States, it might seem like a technical legal case, but it really speaks to this much bigger issue of how our society deals with people whose mental health intersects with the criminal justice system.
It really is. I mean, Jones is a perfect example of how due process plays out in a very specific area of law. It's a landmark case for anyone who wants to understand civil commitment, criminal responsibility, and the evolution of mental health law in this country.
So, to sum it all up, Jones basically said that if you're found NGRI, it changes the whole game. It means the state can treat you differently than a regular criminal defendant, and they don't need as much proof to keep you confined.
That's a great summary. It shows how that NGRI verdict, while it avoids criminal punishment, it actually opens up a whole other set of legal procedures with different rules and considerations.
Well, this has been a really fascinating and, to be honest, a little bit unsettling look at Jones v. United States.
Mm.
It really shows how tough it is to balance the need to protect people with the rights of individuals, especially when mental illness is involved. So for you listening out there, here's something to think about. Given what we've learned about Jones, what do you think about the idea of someone being confined indefinitely for a relatively minor crime, even after the time they would have served for that crime has already passed? Is it ever justified? How do we ensure that the focus remains on treatment and not just punishment? It's a complex issue with huge ethical implications, and it's one that deserves a lot more discussion. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive.
Thanks for having me.